Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. Silk. It's a luxury fabric, a valuable trade good, and a scientific marvel. This material, created by the Bombyx mori silkworm, has captivated artisans for centuries. And it also captivated science presenter and writer Arati Prasad, who was studying the scientific potential of silk for new treatments. That started Arati on a journey to explore the world of silk, not the traditional silk we use today, but all its different varieties. Wild silks made from less famous moths, sea silks made from mollusks, and spider silk, strong yet significantly more difficult to harvest. This all comes together in her latest book, Silk, A History in Three Metamorphoses. Arati Prasad is a writer, broadcaster, and researcher interested in the intersection of science and technology with cultures, history, health, and the environment. She is also the author of In the Bone Setter's Waiting Room, Travels Through Indian Medicine, which was about health and disease in modern India, and Like a Virgin, How Science is Redesigning the Rules of Sex, which explored the history and future of reproduction. Arati has a PhD in genetics from Imperial College London and is an honorary research fellow at University College London's Department of Genetics, Evolution, and Environment. Today, Arati and I explore this world of silk in all its forms and why silk may be the hottest new material in biotechnology today. So, Arati, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about your book, Silk, A History in Three Metamorphoses. Perhaps it's best to start with the traditional silk, which I know your book isn't really about. But how is silk, at least kind of the standard version of it that we all know and mostly use today, how is that kind of silk made, and what made it so prized in the ancient world?
Yeah, there's the silk that most of us will have at home or will buy in a shop. Say if you bought a silk shirt, is predominantly of one type, and it is made by an insect called the Bombyx mori. And the Bombyx mori didn't exist past about 4,000 years ago, and that's because it was sort of genetically engineered by farmers in ancient China, and that's a process of selective breeding where they took a wild ancestor called the Bombyx mandarina mor. It was beautifully colored, very dark, well camouflaged. It flew very fast. And from that, they created over time by selective breeding, which means they were looking for the properties of the insect that would best suit them. For example, that it created bigger cocoons to have more silk. So this insect that we have today, the Bombyx mori, it's colorless. It can't fly to any great degree. It can flap its wings a bit, but it can't go anywhere. It's the only completely domesticated insect that we have. And it's completely dependent on humans, even for basic things like mating and reproducing and being fed. So this moth, the moth develops in a process called complete metamorphosis. And that means it starts life as a tiny caterpillar. So it hatches from the egg, very tiny caterpillar, kind of dark purpley color. And then it eats copious amounts of mulberry leaves. So white mulberry leaves are its natural food plant. And it grows sort of exponentially. And then at some point it stops. It stops eating, it stops moving, and it wraps itself in a cocoon. Because if an insect stops, and it's a very juicy caterpillar by that time, it's subjecting itself to great dangers, both from predators who might want to eat it, but also from infections like bacteria and fungi. And so it wraps itself in a cocoon. And this cocoon is made of silk. And the silk is produced in long tubules that run along the length of the caterpillar's body. And it's a liquid, and it emerges from the salivary glands. And when the liquid hits the air, it solidifies into a thread. And so it wraps itself in this cocoon, and within the cocoon of the Bombyx mori, which is about maybe 4 or so 5 centimeters long, is contained about 1 kilometer of silk thread. The thread's very, very fine. It's about 1,000 times thinner than a human hair. But it's also extremely strong. And because it needs to protect itself, it also has antibacterial, antifungal properties. So when the insect stops developing as a larval form, it wraps itself in the cocoon. What happens there is it starts developing into its adult form. But at this point, people who produce silk take that cocoon. The insect's not allowed generally to develop into an adult, because in the natural process where the moth breaks out of the cocoon, it vomits an enzyme called cocoonase, and that has a kind of dark red color. So number one, it'll stain the cocoon, but more importantly, it breaks the thread, that 1 kilometer of continuous thread, which means that when you try to weave it, you'll have to knot it, and it affects the sort of smooth sheen and the quality of the silk that you'd get from it. So in order to prevent that, the cocoons are routinely, with the pupa, so the insect stage of development inside, is either stifled or boiled, which isn't very nice. But then the cocoons, which contain quite a lot of silk, are boiled, and they're boiled with an alkali, so something like soap, and that unreels the silk strands from the cocoon. The cocoon actually feels very hard. You actually wonder if there's any thread in there at all, because it feels like a papier-mâché or something. But if you boil it, it unreels, and the strands from several cocoons are taken together, pulled out, and made into a reel of thread. And that's how the thread is made. And then that thread is weaved on looms into the products that we wear today.
Right. But your book is not actually about traditional or the kind of the version of silk that we know when we buy in shops. Your book's about all the other kinds of silk. So why write about these other, like the other versions of this fabric? What is it about wild silk or sea silk or spider silk that made you want to write a book about them?
I like writing about things that are less known or understood or are kind of surprising. And I grew up with my mother's family's Indian, and I remember when I was about 10 years old, I was walking in a little village in South India, and I looked into a house and there was a family, including children my age, weaving on a hand loom. So this is a wooden frame where the threads go warp and weft, and they're weaving this silk fabric, and in it there were gold threads. And it was the kind of thing my mother and aunts always wore, that I wore to my 21st birthday, these beautiful productions. And I never thought really beyond that about what this fabric was and where it came from. And I'd always assumed that there was only one type of silk, and that silk came from China, because that's what the popular story says. And I first came to wanting to find out more about silk through science, because I found out that silk was being used in laboratories for technological application. And that really surprised me, not so much in the medical sense, because in ancient China and India and Greece, doctors did use silk for sutures, for example. They still do, because it's a natural animal protein, a biological material. It can be made to not raise an immune response from the human body, but it heals seamlessly into the body. There's a Shakespeare book, I don't remember which one it is exactly, but there's a mention of a spider web, a cobweb, being used to put onto wounds. So we always knew that it was used in medical applications. But they were now talking about the holograms or sensors or human electronic interfaces or implantable surgical materials that were natural, that could be told when to self-destruct, and so not leave any implant like a metal hip replacement in the body, and instead replace it with our own cells. So there were all these manner of things. And then as I spoke to scientists more, they started talking about silk, you know, which makes a lot of sense. It's a natural biological material, as being a very appropriate alternative to the plastics that are really causing our world a problem, because when you produce silk from mulberry trees, for the silk moths in China, they eat mulberry leaves. The carbon locks into the trees, and then you produce the silk from them, and the carbon locks into the fabric. But you can also, if you threw it away, it would biodegrade naturally. It would do the same thing in the body. They were trying to use it as alternative for plastics, because we know very well how to make plastics. So that's bags and cups. But also, electronic waste is a massive problem, and the scientists were making these electronics from silk, as well as implants in the body and that sort of thing. So that's how I first came to it. And then I went to the Natural History Museum in London, and I started looking at silks. I started looking at the types of silks there were. And all of these cocoons from all over the world started falling out of drawers. And they were from India and Africa and all over Europe and the Americas. And I thought, what are these? I've never heard of these. Why are these here? And some of them had Victorian writing on them and tags that said things like Paris Exhibition 1798 and sorry, 1878, so 19th century exhibitions, which were the great colonial exhibitions where the European powers brought anything of economic importance. So that's plants and insects and trees and anthropological objects, and displayed them. And so here were these objects, and I was wondering where they came from. And then when I started speaking to scientists more, they started telling me that, actually, as I mentioned, the kind of clothes that we wear, the silk that we're familiar with, and a lot of the applications that scientists have been working on for technological applications for silk are from the Chinese silk moth. But because the Chinese silk moth was domesticated, I mean, genetic studies have not been able to conclusively validate exactly how long this goes back, but taking together with archaeological evidence, it looks like it's about 4,000 years old. At that time, there's also evidence that silk was being made in other parts of the world. And these silks were not domesticated, or not entirely domesticated. And I'm talking about silk, wild silk moths. So in China, wild silk still kept on being used. It is still being used. The ancestor of the Chinese moth actually spread across the Himalayas and to the foothills of the Himalayas into the west towards India and West Asia. And they continued to face the challenges of the environment and infections that the domesticated moth didn't have to face because they were kept in human care. And that means that the silk that they created have different properties, not just different properties, but you can see that they look different. The cocoons are heavier, they're thicker. When I first saw a wild silk fabric, I didn't believe that it was silk. I had to ask the person in the shop several times, what is this? I thought it was a cotton, a heavy cotton. And so they can be quite thick. They're actually used in the winter. They're passed down for generations. They're very sturdy. And these different types of silk have different applications in technology because of that strength. So I should say, I mentioned that the silk moth silk is 1,000 times thinner than a human hair, but it has an extremely strong tensile strength and elasticity. And so you saw it being used in technological applications for a long time. I think people didn't it didn't go unnoticed that this was a very strong material. Genghis Khan issued his soldiers with a thin silk vest instead of heavy body armor. That had to do with missile arrows. When an arrow goes into your body, it's not nice. But what's worse is when you have to take the arrow out. And as the arrow would go into the silk shirt, the silk would wrap around the arrowhead, making it easier to extract. But also, the silk fibers could meld into the wound of the person, and it does help wound healing. And later in the
Yeah, I mean, I was, I'm jumping ahead in your book a lot, but then this is exactly the same sorts of things that people discover when it comes to silk's bulletproof properties.
Yeah, exactly. So in the 19th century, gun crime became, I mean, it still is a problem, but it became a growing problem in the Wild West of America. There was a doctor called Goodfellow, and he set up a surgical practice above a saloon, so a bar. There were lots of fights down there. So he had prime, front row seats to this, rushed down and would find things and did tests when he saw it because he couldn't quite believe it, that men who were wearing thick woolen felted hats or thick denim clothing, it would make no difference to the bullet. And yet when the bullet would go through a silk handkerchief that was placed in their pocket, folded several times, the bullet was not able to penetrate through the body. And he started doing tests on this. And so many people throughout the centuries after that had been using testing silk. And even the Royal Armouries tested the type that Franz Ferdinand was probably... It is rumored that he had and didn't wear on the day that he was assassinated. So that's not in, it seems bizarre because we think of silk as a very fine fabric, but the properties it has, it's just extraordinary. And you asked, why I started writing about silk and different types of silk. I think silk is such a unique material because it's such an ancient fabric, or it's such an ancient, it's been in use for so long, it continues to be in use, and it has this incredible technological future. And I think there are very few of any objects that we could say the same for. So I was talking about silks from around the world. So as I started looking at silks in the Natural History Museum, I started reading about the history and archaeology. And there's an archaeologist and textile expert at Harvard called Irene Good, and Dr. Good, she said, if you're looking in China and you're excavating and you find a fabric or a thread, of course you're going to check to see if it's silk. But if you find that same thread in Mexico or Cameroon or India or anywhere else, you probably wouldn't. Why would you? But that's exactly what she did. And she found some objects at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts that were from the Indus Valley Civilization. And she tested the silk and looked at the shape of the silk, because silk threads from different moths are unique, and the different animals, in fact, that I've written about are unique in their shape and the size, and it depends on the orifice of the animal from which it emerges. And she found that the ones in India had come from several different types of wild moths, and that it wasn't just about the fact that this was a parallel time. So the time that silk had started being used in China, there's now evidence that it was also being used in India. But that the technology that everyone thought and says was so secret, of the degumming, the not just the fact of we can produce silk, but how do you prepare it in order to make a garment out of it, was practiced on the silk caterpillars from India. And they were probably also stifled like the Chinese moths were, because the silk was a continuous thread and not like the wild silk or the peace silk where the moths were allowed to escape. So, in the people use silk in different ways. In the Pacific, they'd use whole cobwebs or take a part of the web of a spider so as not to disturb the ecology and the natural habitat of the spider, which of course can rebuild, but it's about respect for the natural world. Death shrouds were made from wild moth silk in Madagascar and different parts of Africa as well. So there's a long, long tradition, and it's very international. But the thing about spider silk, spider silk has always been the holy grail of technology. So these are scientists who've been studying silks, and this is going back to the 17th century in Europe. There were scientists; these new scientific societies started to be formed, and people were testing all sorts of things. And a lot of people were amateurs, but entomology and natural history was something that there was a great interest for. And scientists suggested that, one of the big problems about domestication, or another way to put it is inbreeding, is that diseases emerge and the animals are less able to protect themselves from parasites. And so the domesticated, or the Chinese silk moth, as it went across Europe, started sickening, and alternatives were being sought. And so they suggested, picking up spider webs and try to create small garments. They only ever succeeded in achieving small garments out of spider silk. And that's because spiders are extremely uncooperative. You can domesticate a moth, But spiders are not. First of all, they're cannibalistic. So when a large object was finally created about 10 years ago from the Madagascan golden orb spider, the creators of it, Simon Pierce and Nicholas Godley, took about 2 million spiders in 8 years, because at first women, Malagasy women, would go out and collect spiders in a big basket. And Simon said, but they'd come back and there'd just be one very happy looking spider left in the basket. And so the question of the difficulties of using certain silks is the ability to get quantities of it. And over time, In different places, strange contraptions started being invented, where you would immobilize a spider and extract the silk directly from its abdomen, which they really didn't like. And you can release them afterwards and then sort of silk them again. But that it wasn't a very efficient system. And that
did
meant...
They never figured out how to do this economically, right? It was always very expensive and requiring a lot of inputs, I guess the word would be, as in like just keeping them all fed with flies and stuff. They never figured out how to make this economical, right?
No, and they still really haven't. But what's astonishing is the creativity that's gone into this. So not long ago, there's a scientist in America called Randy Lewis, and he... also, I think he was working with a lab that also tried to extract spider silk in the old way, but then started making genetically modified organisms to ask them, the more cooperative ones like E. coli bacteria or yeast. So the yeast that we make beer with, they multiply very rapidly. So if you put some spider silk genes into them and ask them to create spider silk for us, they will create something like it. That none of them were very successful. So then he created the first mammal that had spider silk genes in it. And that was known as spider and spider goat. So when you milked it, the spider silk would come out in the milk. But none of these things are great, because he only used a small part of the spider silk gene, so it would only produce a part of the protein. But remember, the spiders are really quite amazing. They make many types of silk for different purposes, to wrap their eggs in, to make their webs, to drop down from, and they have different properties. But it comes out as a solid, like the silkworm. It's not a liquid. So if you're creating a liquid and then you have to try and fold it into a thread, you have to guess how that's done. And you know, it's often said what a spider has been able to do on a diet of bugs has, you know, evaded scientists and technologists, and that's still the case. So the latest thing he's done is use the Bombyx mori silkworm. So he's genetically engineered. He said, you know, look, we've been using this for 4,000 years, so why not put the spider silk genes into them and let them make the thread? Of course, it'll be part silkworm and part spider silk fabric. But yeah, I mean, some people have been so successful. In the Second World War, both silk moths and spiders were co-opted and conscripted by the militaries in various places. The Nazis very interestingly tried to use the silkworm as a model for eugenics, which is so deeply flawed because, as I said, they're very inbred, and another word for inbred is racially pure or pure, genetically pure, and they got very sick. And so he sent them to schools. You know, the Nazis sent them to schools as well as mulberry trees. They planted mulberry trees everywhere, and they used the worms to teach children about the value of, you know, if this animal is sick, then, you know, they should die. They shouldn't be, you know, they shouldn't be a part of society. But the reason they did that was to create parachutes. And they wove it in such a way that the silk parachutes were fire retardant. And so you had situations where people would look up into the sky, like there was a battle in Heraklion in Crete, and you see thousands of these silk parachutes coming down. And people were forbidden to touch them. But of course, after the war was over and the Nazis were defeated, the women in Crete, who also had a local wild silk industry and Chinese silk industry for hundreds of years, picked up the parachutes and made wedding dresses and handkerchiefs and scarves out of them. With the spiders, spider silk is incredible for so many reasons, but it's extremely fine. And even stronger than moth silk. And it is said that if the spider was the size of a human, then the web it creates could stop a jetliner in its path. So extremely strong, but the fineness of it was also used for another purposes in crosshairs. Crosshairs are what you use in the finest of military equipment, can also be used in medical equipment. And there was a woman called Nan Songer in California, and she loved spiders as a child, but as part of the war effort, she started collecting black widow spiders and silking them, so milking them for their threads. And the American military used to come to her house with a briefcase handcuffed to them and pick up the silk that she'd been able to produce. So it was enough for some purposes. After the war, she made it for medical equipment. But, you know, I also, you know, wanted to say that it's silk is, it's very sustainable. And because this is the other thing about looking at wild silks and not just at the domesticated silk, is they exist in their natural habitats across the world. So everywhere. And that means that if people had silk industries, or if silk industries were recreated in countries that had them or lost them, or where they could be revived, in order to grow silk moths and silk worms, you need trees. You need the natural habitats of those places. As I said, it locks carbon in. If we can find a way to make less water use natural dyes, for example, that's fantastic. The problem with the domesticated silk or in semi-domesticated silks that they use in India, where the moths are killed, it's not really ideal. However, in terms of sustainability, there was an interesting case where Professor Neri Oxman, she was at MIT Media Lab, and she created a giant sort of architectural scaffolds. And she didn't extract the silk from the silk worms. Instead, she created these, like, they looked like sort of rounded scaffolds, different shapes, thinking about sustainable building materials, right? And she put thousands of silk worms on the structure, and they went ahead and built it for her. So, there are ways of using silks as long as the animals are present, and it can be done in a more sustainable and compassionate way. One of the my very favorite organisms that I had no idea about before I started writing this book is actually a mollusk. It's neither a spider nor a moth, and this one lives in the Mediterranean Sea. The problem with this, of course, is it's critically endangered because of climate change. The Mediterranean's heating, it's getting hotter. And with the heat, it's a lot of infectious organisms that have wiped its population, have pushed it right to the brink. And this mollusk, it's kind of like, you know, the blue mussels you might eat. They have a little thread at the end, and they use that to anchor themselves onto surfaces. So this is a version of the kind of mollusk that's about, it can grow up to a meter tall, and it sends out these threads. It doesn't spin them, it blow molds them. So it sends it out, and it anchors itself into the sediment of the Mediterranean Sea. And those mollusks, because they're so big, they create a lot, there's a lot of meat in them, and people have been fishing them for millennia. And probably also weaving them for millennia, because when you take them out for meat, the meat tastes disgusting, apparently. The Romans described it as a diuretic. So I think only people who couldn't afford anything, would eat it, because it's quite a lot of, like, a kilo or something in there. And then the hairs would be there. It would grow as long as, you know, if a person had a bob haircut, that's how long it would be. So quite long. And it's really a wonderful color. It changes in the light from gold to bronze to green. And it has been woven for a very long time. We're not really quite sure how long, because it doesn't survive. The first real record that's believable was by a scientist in Hungary, but this was in the think around the 1920s. And there's a place in Hungary that's called the Quincum, and it's one of the northernmost borders of the Roman Empire. And a lot of the soldiers were from North Africa. And they found several urn graves, and there were women who were mummified in the Egyptian style. And they opened this sarcophagus, and she was wearing a dress that he looked under the microscope, and he knew the difference between plant fabrics and animal fibers, because that's what he studied. And this had a very characteristic linguine shape, like a flattened, rounded spaghetti. And unfortunately, in the Second World War, the museum was bombed and the sample was lost. But that's the oldest recorded. After that, there are records of it being made in Sicily and in the south of Italy, and where I went to see it in Sardinia, on a small island called Sant'Antioco, where people are still weaving old samples of it. You can no longer harvest it from the sea because it's endangered. What's interesting about this silk technologically, it's not like spider silk or moth silk. So spider silk and moth silk, you know, I was talking about putting it into the body. Well, it's very similar to keratin, collagen, elastin. So that's an abundant protein in the human body, in the mammalian body. Sea silk's not like that. So the muscles that you eat, it is like a collagen. The muscles that you eat, it produces a little thread that's similar to collagen. But the sea silk's quite unique. It's more like a fiber that's in our muscles that is there for contraction. But the great thing about it is it has self-healing properties. You know, it self-repairs. So it's been trialed for things like fetal surgery, where, you know, can you imagine a fabric, if you create something that's able to heal itself, that in itself is wonderful for technology. And it's not the only animal. There's a very funny shrimp-like animal that a scientist called Professor Volrath, he studies spiders and anything, really, anything that produces threads. At Oxford University. And this is a shrimp-like animal, tiny. It's called C. bonellii. And this doesn't blow mold. It actually spins a thread. And the thread that it spins is somewhere between the kind of cement that barnacles use to affix themselves to rocks and ships' hulls, between that and the strength of spider silk. And that has adhesive properties. So how, you know, to create an adhesive that works underwater as well. So I think looking at the natural world, there's this whole field of biomimicry, trying to understand what can nature do that we really can't? Because in order to be more sustainable, you know, nature doesn't waste. It recycles everything. We've become past masters at throwing things away, and things that don't degenerate or aren't biodegradable. So, you know, the whole idea with this is I came to it thinking about this luxurious fabric. I fell down a rabbit hole of the archaeology and the history, but then really started becoming in awe of all the animals across the world that make materials that are really quite extraordinary. Not just extraordinary in the beauty of them, but in the properties that they have and in the way that we could learn from them and apply them to prevent further, you know, destruction of our own world.
So, you know, two similar questions. The first, I mean, obviously, you know, sea silk was quite hard to make, or there were maybe people that worked with sea silk. With climate change and environmental damage, it's even rarer now. You say you can't harvest that silk anymore. Spider silk also, as you noted, extremely difficult to harvest and to produce economically. Are there still surviving garments either with sea silk or spider silk today that people can see? Are there any left?
Oh yeah, no, plenty. There is a lady called Felicitas made it, and she is in Europe, and she has made an online museum of sea silk, and she has been doing this, collecting photos of samples across the world. In Sardinia, I saw the most beautiful large shawl made of it, golden in color. You know, the Chinese silk, it's one thing that's really good about it is it takes dyes very easily. Wild silk's very hard to dye because of the sort of protein structure of one of the components of it. But sea silk, I told you about the gold, like golden color. The golden orb spider has a natural golden color. A lot of the wild moths also come in different colors. That's not a pigment. That's a kind of nanoscale particle. That means it never ever fades, and that's another good point for sustainability. But yeah, I've seen them, and they still retain the colors in them. There are a lot of other animals like the pinna nobilis, the mussel that people eat across East and Southeast Asia that are routinely thrown away, and I don't think the fibers are woven. But there are weavers in Sicily, I'm sorry, it's not Sicily, in Sardinia now, who are sourcing these sea silks from the species that still are abundant. Not, you know, also mindful that we don't want to wipe anything up, but if they're being eaten, and if they're being eaten sustainably, then it's a shame to throw the threads away. The spider silk in 2012, huge shawls and textiles were made in Madagascar by Simon Pierce, and they were exhibited in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. You can see them online, and he tours them sometimes in different museums. That is so bright gold. The web is gold. And the web can be several meters across, and those spiders are very abundant in Madagascar. Simon's son told me that, yeah, you see them everywhere in urban areas and everywhere. So yeah, they can still be collected, and the ancient objects can still be seen today.
And, you know, similarly, same type of question, but I expect the answer is very different. When it comes to the wild silks, these kind of different, I guess you can call them the alternative silks. If you wanted to be nonconformist and look for one of these alternative silk garments, where in the world can you find them? Where in the world can you buy clothing made of these different silks today?
Well, they do make them in China. They use a wild silk moth still. These moths, you know, the Bombyx mori, the domesticated one, they're tiny. They're about, I don't know, maybe 4 centimeters or so across, and they're kind of colorless and don't really move, and they're very boring. The wild moths you'll see in China, across Asia, across the world, are kind of the size of a hand or two hands put together. They're wonderfully colored, huge, and there is an industry in China, but also in India. There are many different types of wild silks that are still used, and you can buy the threads, and you can buy fabrics made of them. So you can look them up. They're called Tassar, which is Tasar, Mugga and Eri. They're very popular because they have different qualities. So they're so robust, they're passed down for generations. You can wear them in the winter because they keep you warm. You know, when I've given talks about my book recently, so many people have come to me. There was a scientist from Sudan, and she said, you know, I had very bad eczema, and my doctor told me to sleep on silk and wear silk, and it disappeared. And someone else told me, oh, my daughter had rosacea, and it went away. So I think people sort of have known anecdotally and across the world worn these fabrics for different purposes. And yeah, you can find them if you look up wild silk textiles. Some of them are semi-domesticated, but the other good thing about them is that they do live in the wild. The cocoons are harvested from the wild, and that means again that they live in forests, and that means that the forests need to be preserved in order to continue the industry. So it's an industry that has to respect the environment, or it will no longer exist. And so it's quite nice to buy products that are made of wild silk, they have a different texture to them, because some, like peace silk, you may have heard of. What happens is the cocoon's broken by the moth as it emerges, so the strands have to be tied together. So you get these little, very little bumps in them, and there've been debates throughout time. You know, there was a Victorian man called Thomas Wardle, and he was knighted by Queen Victoria for services to silk, because he really brought Indian silk, wild silk from India, into the British market, and figured out how to dye it in wonderful gem-like colors, he called it. And there was a scientific debate one day. He was presenting his findings and he said, oh, you know, but the Indians don't know how to make silk very well because the fabrics are quite, you know, vernacular or rough. And another man stood up and said, yes, but maybe that's the beauty of them, because this was the time William Morris worked with Wardle too and learned how to dye with natural dyes from him. Wardle was a chemist. And the whole mood at that time, a little bit like now, was like questioning, you know, is factory made the best, or is this arts and crafts? Is there something that we're losing by not making things by manufacture, by hand? And so, you know, there was also a call to look at the natural beauty of things. What is this idea of perfection? You know, can we work with things without having to change them? Can we tread lightly in the materials that we use? So, yeah, I think people also breed silkworms. You can get them. I got Bombyx mori silkworms eggs I hatched at home, and those you can get from pet shops because they use them to feed to reptiles. But if you're curious, it's the most wonderful thing to do to raise them at home and see how they spin. It's really magical. And friends told me that they raised silkworms as a child and they fed them lettuce, for example, and the silk turned green, or, you know, the carrots. Or the best silk will come if the animals eat the plants that they're used to eating in their natural habitat. That means the strongest, best quality. But they can eat other things and become other colors. So people do keep wild silk moths as well, which are very, very impressive to look at. So yeah, it's a wonderful thing to see. Yeah, and more and more important these days to understand where things come from and the value of them.
You know, I think I'd like to end by kind of coming back to maybe the thing that got you started on this journey. The first was kind of looking at a lot of the kind of new scientific applications of silk. And so I guess to ask a broad question, kind of what's the future of silk? How are we going to see silk, whether it's the traditional kind or these alternatives? How are we going to see this being used more and more in the future of kind of science and technology?
The thing that excites me most, because I have a background in biomedicine, is the medical and surgical applications for it. So a lot of these things are in clinical trials, so and they're being tested, and you know, you can't really use them until they're safe to use. That silk can integrate into your body. So if it's something like I don't know, a part of your body that can be easily removed, that's one thing. But if it integrates deep inside and you have some kind of immune problem, then that would be terrible. So it has to be tested really well. Having said that, there has already been a treatment of vocal cord paralysis. And the professor who was working on this, Fiorenzo Menetto in Boston, he said that, you know, you saw people walking in not being able to speak and then coming out having this silk-based implant to replace the vocal cords. And then they healed and were able to speak. So I think that's a space to watch. They're looking at making replacements for cartilage and bone and artificial blood vessels. So, for example, instead of putting a metal hip replacement in, you could 3D print a scaffold of silk and then take your own bone cells and seed the scaffold. That means put your cells on it and let them grow, and so that the silk can dissolve and what you're left with is just your bone, like genuinely your bone and not anything that didn't belong in you. Also looking at implantable, dissolvable nuts and gears and bolts for surgery. So I think that's all quite exciting because it's a gentler way to perform surgery, and it's a natural biodegradable product. You know, medicine is extremely unsustainable. You know, we saw that with COVID and the masks and all the equipment that we need. So anything that can be done to improve that is wonderful. Also, in terms of medicine and delivery, we saw with COVID, one of the problems with vaccines, and we know that sending vaccines to parts of the world where it's difficult to store them in cold temperatures is the stabilization. And silk has been used to temperature stabilize vaccines, penicillin, chemotherapy drugs for over a decade at the Mayo Clinic in America already. So those things, I think, I'll watch this space. They need to be tested for safety, but they will be with us. The other things that are very exciting is the creation of biodegradable materials to replace the things that we use every day and throw away, like bags and cups, but also the human electronic interfaces that I was talking about.
Oh, yeah.
So there's sensors you can say you stuck a silk sensor on an apple and, you know, it could track food waste, but it's completely edible and safe to eat. Or my mother forgot to take her medication. And there was a, you'd implant a sensor into the drug that would feed back to my app and tell me mm-hmm. that she's taken it. Fiorenzo Ominato said, you know, the fact that we start from a naturally based material drives us to put tech where tech normally doesn't go. And it brings biology and technology together. And that, I think that's what I find most exciting. I think all the scientists I've spoken to, you know, I came to them thinking about medical applications, and actually what they're all excited about is the applications in sustainability and for climate change. So I think that's really the space that they're working in now. It can be used as a fabric. We can make different kinds of fabrics from different purposes, but there's nothing exciting about that in terms of the form of a textile. Mm-hmm. You know, body armor is a textile. Yeah, it gets more exciting when we look at, as I said, things that can self-heal. How does this silk do that, and how can we do that in the body? If we can't produce enough of it, we can try to learn how the animal does it, and try and replicate that ourselves. So either way, understanding how silk's made, where it comes from, and the breadth of species that make it and how it's made, the environmental challenges that these animals have to face and the solutions they've found, very much like the problems we have and the solutions we need to find. So I think that's the space that's most exciting, and it's being worked on the most.
Oh, as you suggest, I will be watching that space too, to see kind of what new, what new applications, ones that I never considered, I guess, for silk. I think that's a good place to end our conversation with Arati Prasad, author of Silk, Silk, A History in Three Metamorphoses. Arati, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, number one, where can people find your work and all of your work, not just this book? And number two, what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
My books are... They're definitely on Kindle, but they're out there in shops and online. And I always have tried to write things that take an alternative perspective. So my first book was about the future of reproduction, so looking at ideas from the history and the future of human reproduction, but also lots of very strange and interesting animal species. The second one was looking at health and disease in India. And then silk has been my third. I'm thinking of some ideas for my next book, but they will definitely be, I'm thinking of one that's going to bring together our knowledge of human disease, but also anthropology and the human body with a very feminist angle. So that's what I'm thinking of next.
Look forward to hearing more about it. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRigordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you still guys listen to Asian Review Books podcast. We're on all of your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Arabjyoti Saikia, author of The Quest for Modern Assam, A History, 1942 to 2000. But before then, Arati, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much, Nick.